You're about to listen to a Second City Works presentation, brought to you in partnership with WGN Radio. Subscribe on your favorite podcast streaming platform or listen on WGNradio.com. And be sure to share.
Hi, just a couple of housekeeping notes before we start. Although the Second City's live theater and live classes are not happening, we have turned everything virtual. You can take Second City classes in writing, in improv, and acting. There's a kids camp. We're also doing virtual corporate webinars and keynotes and workshops. It's all really kind of amazing, everything that we've been able to turn around. Plus, Second City is offering live improv shows on Tuesdays, Thursdays, and Saturdays. You can get all that information at www.secondcity.com. Check it out.
The Second City is a world-famous comedy theater, and it got so famous because it has produced generation after generation of comedy superstars. That didn't happen by magic. Second City's improvisational pedagogy fuels great performance, and the same practices that made stars of everyone from Bill Murray to Tina Fey can be applied for success offstage, at work, at home, and in the world. I'm Kelly Leonard, Executive Director of Insights and Applied Improvisation at the Second City. This podcast is about collaborative conversations, seeking connections, and finding a better way. This is Getting the Yes And.
Days can't be counted by the money spent. Today was just another better left unsaid. Days can't be counted by the time to rent. Tomorrow's just another like the one that comes next. The corner of the highway that leads to the job, at the desk by the boss with the elegant watch. The tick of the clock and the tick of the clock mark the moments till the ticking.
My guest today on Getting the Yes And is Catherine Sanderson. Catherine is the Maxwell Family Professor in Life Sciences at Amherst College and the author of The Positive Shift: Mastering Mindset to Improve Happiness, Health, and Longevity. She has written five college textbooks, including real-world psychology, and widely taught middle and high school health textbooks. Catherine lectures around the country and was chosen by Princeton Review as one of the best college teachers in America. She has a new book. It's called Why We Act: Turning Bystanders into Moral Rebels. Catherine Sanderson, welcome back to the show.
Thank you so much for the opportunity to talk again, Kelly.
So this is our first podcast taping since the world got turned upside down because of the coronavirus. We're actually recording this via Zoom technology, which did not come out easily to start, but we're here. I'm in my home. Catherine, where are you?
I am in my home as well.
Okay, so we're taping this on March 18th, 2020. Second City had to close its doors last weekend. WGN Radio is limiting how many people can come into the studio. Catherine, I imagine your classes are moving online, right?
All of my classes are online, and in fact, I'm not even allowed in my office anymore. Our office is totally closed, and faculty are not allowed on campus.
Wow. Yeah, I think for us, we have to get special permission if we want to come into the building even to get something. So it is a very different world from when you wrote this book, from when we last spoke. But I would say finishing your book over the weekend, I did note two things. One, that the book is extremely timely, given everything that's going on in the world, but it's actually not a new story. The essence of human behavior that you look at seems to be as old as humanity itself.
That's absolutely right. And in fact, one of the things that was so interesting to me, because of course, I'm a psychologist, I don't read naturally as part of my work historical, you know, nonfiction, and I found myself immersed in reading about the Holocaust and the civil rights movement and lynchings and so on. And you're exactly right. It's not a new story.
The first chapter is called The Myth of Monsters. And you pose the rhetorical question, why do we assume that bad behavior is carried out by bad people? Talk to us about that. Why do we need to create these monsters?
I think it's really self-protective. I think if we say there are bad people and there are good people, then we can feel safe. Okay, well, I'm a good person, so I wouldn't do one of those things. Or I'm a good parent, and so my kids wouldn't do one of those things. And I titled that chapter specifically from a wonderful book written by Sue Klebold, whose son was one of the two high school seniors who, of course, committed the horrible school shooting in Columbine so many years ago. And she writes so eloquently about how people assume it must be bad parenting and she must be a bad person to have raised this child and not noticed his proclivity, ability to commit those acts. And I really wanted people to understand that this isn't something that is as simple as good people and bad people, that all of us at times don't behave as we wish we had.
You also write in this chapter that, quote, people will do things in a group setting that they would never do on their own. So that's a real important aspect of this, too, is that it's about behavior in groups being just very different.
Yes. And of course, as you've noted, we see that time and time again. I mean, virtually every example of a college student, typically a male, who has some major issue, sometimes actually resulting in death, related to fraternity hazing or sports team hazing or so on. In many of those cases, these seem like otherwise, you know, good, healthy, athletic people. And yet in a group setting, people individually lose sight of who they are and who they want to be. And a group makes it very easy to lose a sense of yourself as a distinct person.
One of the things I love about the book, too, is there's just so much rich evidence and, you know, really pointing to the science behind this. But one of those pieces of science that was done by someone who was inspired by something that happened to them, and this is Mina Sakara at MIT.
Yes.
Can you tell us about that story?
Well, so I really do love this story. But so it's a description of someone who I think at the time was either a graduate student or a postdoc at Princeton, but went with her husband to see a Yankees game. And her husband had the bad fortune of choosing to wear a Boston Red Sox hat and proceeded to get absolutely tormented by Yankees fans. And she was astonished. And in fact, thinking, well, people surely wouldn't treat a woman that way, she switched hats and she wore the Red Sox hat. And again, she experienced the exact same kind of abuse. And that's an example to the extent to which in group settings, people don't behave well. And it's also really an example about how easily we divide people into us and them. They weren't seen as fellow baseball lovers. They were seen as Red Sox fans, you know, the enemy.
There's another sports story that you bring up later, a study where it's someone wearing a Manchester United jersey, right?
Exactly. And that's, again, an example of how much our loyalty really can be based on seemingly really trivial things, which is your favorite soccer team in this example, and that people are more likely to help somebody who has fallen and appears to have injured their leg if that person is wearing a T-shirt that in fact is your own favorite team, and much less likely to do so if that person still in need of help is wearing a T-shirt from an opposing team.
All right. Well, all of this makes so much sense when you think about where we are politically right now as a country, because it's not about policies. It's about our tribe.
Absolutely. And what's interesting, I think, in the sports example, and frankly, in the sort of, you know, red state, blue state example, is that these are not things that are genetically determined. It's not even things like, you know, race or sex.
Right.
It's things that are so simplistic, right? I mean, you can switch allegiance to a sports team very easily. You can switch political parties very easily. And yet, it is very much about who's in our tribe.
I want to talk about bystander effect. And you talk about this famous incident that happened a few years back in Chicago when Dr. David Dow, who's a 69-year-old physician, and I mean, we all remember this, he was forcibly removed from a United Airlines flight. And pretty much people were silent about it, or actually just filmed it, you know, to show on social media.
Right. And I use that example when I give talks about this, because I start by saying, who remembers that case of that man who was dragged off the United plane? And virtually everybody does. You know, you get a huge number of people raising their hands. And then I say, well, why do you remember it? And they remember it because people videoed it. You know, otherwise you would have no idea. Before the age of smartphones, we wouldn't know what had happened. So people recognized this isn't good. This is a problem. And that's why so many people took out their phones and videoed it, which we've seen. And yet what struck me about that story was all of those people videoing could have made a different choice. They could have stood up and said, don't take him off the plane or stop what you're doing or I'm going to call 911. And they didn't.
So that also points to the study that you write about by John Darley of NYU and Bibliotheque of Columbia. And this was these college students. And can you set up that experiment? Because I thought that was fascinating.
Okay, so I talk about a couple of different studies with them. So let me know which one you're talking about. I don't want to ruin the punchline.
Yeah, it was the college students and who went to help and who didn't.
Yes, and was it about the seizure study? Is that the one you're going to? There's another study that I also talk about, a smoke-filled room with those same authors. In this study that you're describing, they had college students come in, put them in what they thought were private rooms so they could have a discussion, and one of the other participants, identified as he had a seizure disorder, and in fact, being in a small enclosed space might lead to a trigger of a seizure. And if he needed help, you know, somebody should go and tell the experimenter if he started to show signs of slurring his speech. And in one condition, the students believed that all of the other five group members could hear this particular student. And in another case, they believed that they were the only one who could hear him because of some malfunction with this particular person's intercom system. And what they found is that when students believed they were the only one who could hear him, most people, 85%, did stand up and get the experimenter. Now, I will say that always raises the question of who were those 15% of people who believed they were the only... I mean, I got to be honest, that has always struck me. What kind of a person is just like, oh, well, I won't go help and I'm the only one. But on the more positive side, 85% of people do, you know, stand up and go get help. But when the students believe that other people are easily available to help and can also recognize what's going on, most students do nothing. Most students just continue to sit there because, again, there's the feeling of diffusion of responsibility. Well, you know, somebody else can help. It doesn't have to be me.
That is amazing. It's interesting because, I mean, I guess we know about hiding out in groups, but I can't imagine like hiding out in a group of two. You know, for something like this, it just seems impossible.
It does. And yet we see this, you know, time and time again, in which, you know, there's somebody has some kind of a call for help or somebody recognizes there's a problem. And we hear it time and time again, historically and anecdotally, that many people don't step up and do anything.
Yeah, and this ties into a concept I had never heard before, but when I was reading the book, I'm my wife Anne was like in the chair across from me, I'm like, you gotta hear, do you know the term social loafing? And she said no. And I basically read this chapter to her. So tell our audience what social loafing is.
Yeah, so what's funny is that social loafing is a concept that I think many people actually do know what it is. They just don't know the name of it. But it refers to the description of when you're in a group setting, each person individually sort of slacks off because they're assuming the other people so they can socially loaf because other people will in fact pick up the slack. When I describe this to my college students, overwhelmingly I use the example of who here has ever worked as a waiter or waitress and why do they have a mandatory tip on large parties? And of course they have a mandatory tip on large parties because people loaf. They don't contribute their fair share. It's also why many college students really hate group projects because group projects raise the issue of everybody's going to try to socially loaf. If you care about your grade, you're going to have to do so much work to compensate for all of the other people who are like, oh, good, it's a group project. I don't have to actually help so much.
And this, the Berlin Institute of Technology study was interesting. So these were individuals and then pairs monitoring an automated system, and they behave differently because of being alone or with people.
Right. So this was a case in which they were literally simulating that this is a production line and it needs to be working well or it's going to lead to a catastrophic failure. Mm-hmm. And so you think sort of, you know, hey, you know, four eyes are better than two, right? Twice as many people who can pick up on a problem. And yet what they found was the reverse, because knowing somebody else is also going to be helping leads you to feel less responsibility, so you do it less diligently. And so it really raises lots of practical implications in virtually all fields, because we assume, well, if somebody else is going to check it, I don't need to be quite as diligent. And what they found, in fact, was people working alone were able to identify more problems than people working in pairs.
So this struck me as a thing improvisation is getting at, this like individual skill building and collaborating for maximum effect, where it's basically, because it is, we're nudging you with these principles and these ideas, because it is not natural for people to collaborate well.
Right. And that also raises the issue of each person in that setting could sort of slack off and say, well, my partner is going to pick up the next line, or my partner can take responsibility here. Do I really have to step up? And I think your answer would be, you need to step up, right?
Well, because an audience is going to see that, you know, and I mean, that's in the studies too. You know, when eyes are on us, we also behave differently.
Yes, absolutely.
I thought it was interesting that in this chapter, you talked about the fact that people step up more quickly to help in an emergency when they are in the presence of children.
Yes. And I think what's interesting about that is we sort of recognize that children are less competent, right? So I can't really socially loathe. I can't really refuse to take action, because if I'm in the presence of a child, I probably do need to be the person who helps. So in that sense, we can see some scenarios in which this natural social loafing tendency is decreased.
So one of the things we talk a lot about in our work is the importance of specificity, both in improvisation and comedy. Like the reason you find something really funny is because it's highly specific. You also talk about the opposite of specificity, that ambiguity can be the cause of whether someone chooses to act or not act.
Yes, and I think this in some senses gets at the challenge that many of us face in lots of situations, where in some cases, it's very, very clear there's a problem. But in many cases, it's very hard for us to know exactly what's going on. We see this in many cases of alcohol poisoning with college students, that college students are like, well, is he really drunk, or is he actually in trouble and I should call 911? It's just kind of ambiguous. We see it in cases of sexual misconduct, in which it's not really clear if it's consensual or if it's kind of crossed the line. And in many cases, then people feel that maybe something's wrong, but they're not certain. And so that level of ambiguity leads people to look to other people to see, well, how is everybody else reacting? And the challenge is that if everyone is looking to everyone else, and everyone is kind of trying to appear cool and not overreacting, it can lead no one to actually get the help they need.
So this is particularly apt right now. I mean, specifically like this week. So I went to go drop my dog off at boarding, and he goes to a place called the Wild. They're terrific. And they set up a whole system where we're basically 10 feet apart, go into the sort of walkway, hook them up, and then they come get them, so that we're practicing the social distancing. We're doing it. And then I stopped in at the grocery store just to get a couple things. No, everyone is crowded right next to each other. No one is like, and I'm really going, what are you doing? And then driving further, there's a bunch of people playing basketball. And I'm like, what is happening?
Well, no. And I really think that, you know, I don't know when this is going to air. And I shudder to think how much things might change from when you and I are talking today to whenever someone listens to this. But the reality is that is exactly the challenge that we are all facing, is what's going on. So my school, I teach at Amherst College, closed on Monday, March 9th. An email was sent to all students and faculty saying, you know, students need to clear out and we're not going to be having class in person for the rest of the semester. And so Monday, March 9th, it seemed like a crazy overreaction that very, very few schools were doing it. You know, a couple, like I think Stanford and the University of Washington were doing it, but that was only because there was like a hot spot. You know, we had no students on campus had been diagnosed. There was no, you know, diagnosis in the area. And it really seemed like an overreaction. And so the students were furious. Yeah. And yet, that's the kind of challenge where it seems very ambiguous. Is this really what's going on? And I think one of the keys is that when we recognize that there's an actual emergency, it's much, much easier to act. I describe an example in the book, my own senior year of college, I was a student at Stanford, and I was at Stanford in a psychology class when the 1989 Loma Prieta earthquake happened. So the building shakes, but there's a case where everybody totally, totally understands this is an earthquake. It's an earthquake. It's a problem. People could see, you know, damage to buildings, you know, a bridge collapse in San Francisco. There was no ambiguity. It was very, very clear what's happening. The challenge with the times that we're literally living in right now is that it's very unclear. You know, what causes it? Do I have it? You know, is it really safe to go to the gym or go to a restaurant or whatever? And that ambiguity is making it, I think, really hard for people to know whether they're underreacting or overreacting.
Well, because as you also point out in the book, there's a cost to helping sometimes. I mean, it can be not a good experience for someone.
Yes, and when you say not a good experience, there's a lot, that sentence is doing a lot of work, right?
Yeah,
because it can be, right? It can be not a good experience as in, you know, you don't get promoted because your boss, you know, thinks you keep calling out racist, you know, or sexist or homophobic language.
Yeah.
And so you don't get that promotion, it goes to somebody else. In some cases, of course, you try to help and be the good Samaritan, and it can actually be life-threatening. And
yeah.
So that's the challenge, right? That you can be seen as irritating, you can be seen as overreacting, but in some cases, you can actually put your life at risk. And that's another factor that inhibits action in lots of cases.
Can you talk to us about the study that they did at Princeton at the Theological Seminary?
Yes. So this is really, it's a classic study. It's one of my favorites. And they had aspiring ministers, so people who were in training to be ministers, come in and learn how to deliver a speech. And they were all told that the speech was going to be on the parable of the Good Samaritan. So these are all aspiring ministers. And they're all giving a speech on the parable of the Good Samaritan. And yet, they then assigned these men, they were all men, to one of three conditions. One set of men were told, oh, you know, we ran out of time. You know, you need to really hurry over to the next building. You know, you're really late, really hurry. Another group of men were told, yeah, it's getting to the time. We should probably walk over. And the third group of men were told, you know, we have plenty of time. Whenever you're ready, we should head over. So all aspiring ministers, all had just practiced to deliver the sermon on the Good Samaritan, of course, a story that describes helping those in need, and they have created an emergency. So the men walk out of the building, and there's somebody on the front steps who's coughing and seeming, you know, really, really not in good shape, having trouble catching their breath, looking, you know, very ill. And the question is, who stops? And what they find is that, again, even in this very small group of people who were all, again, highly selected, want to be ministers, and presumably were thinking about the need to help other people given the sermon they had just practiced, what they found was that people who were in a hurry were very unlikely to help. People who were not in a hurry were very likely to help. And so once again, it's not necessarily are there good people, bad people. It's about the situation we're in. If you're in a hurry, the cost of helping is greater.
So, like, literally, it's a cost-benefit analysis that's being done.
Literally.
Like, subconsciously.
Yeah. Perhaps subconsciously and perhaps consciously, right? Perhaps it's, yeah, like, oh, you know, I would help, but I'm really running late, so I'm just going to keep going.
You also note in another study that people were significantly less likely to help if that person was bleeding.
Right. And again, when you talk about bleeding, there's a significant potential cost. And then not just, oh, I might get my suit dirty or whatever, but it could be I might get AIDS. You know, I might get really ill. You know, blood has lots of contagion. And so there's a case when it kind of cuts against the point that we described earlier about ambiguity. When there's blood, it's not ambiguous. No one's like bleeding. That's a normal, you know, thing that people do. But when there's bleeding, it increases, it provides greater clarity, greater specificity, but it also leads to greater cost of helping and it inhibits action.
Yeah. Looking at all the various factors is interesting because also it could change based on where you are, geographical location.
Absolutely. And the cost of helping may be different depending on if you are in a rural area, if you're in an urban setting, if you're a tourist, if you're visiting. It also, you know, in fairness, may be influenced by who you are. So that women may feel more vulnerable to helping because they may be physically smaller or weaker. And so there are lots of different factors, of course, that can influence the relative cost-benefit analysis that people are making.
Yeah, you talk a bit about too office behavior here, and the idea that, and this is from the book, quote, confronting someone who uses offensive language or engages in derogatory behavior takes cognitive and emotional energy. And this goes along with the fact that most people don't report sexual assaults, and most people don't tell on people who are bosses who are behaving badly. And it's not just the normal sort of fear. It's that literally there's like, I think you also talk about the part of the brain that is going on here is similar to part of the brain that feels physical pain.
Absolutely. And being socially rejected, research in neuroscience now tells us being socially rejected. So having your colleagues ostracize you or your fraternity brothers ostracize you, that feeling socially rejected feels at a physiological, neurological level like experiencing physical pain, you know, burning yourself with hot coffee on your arm or whatever. And that's a reason why we so often don't report things, even when we know that they really shouldn't be happening, that we're very unlikely to take that risk in many settings.
I thought it was interesting, too, when you talk about men in this sort of area, that men tend to overestimate how much other men held sexist beliefs and underestimated their level of discomfort with sexist behavior, that we're kind of doing this to ourselves based on a norm that maybe is not the norm.
Yes, and I actually find that a really hopeful finding, to be honest, because I think one of the keys is that we often feel inhibited because we're worried about the social consequences, but we're not actually correctly assuming, understanding what other people are thinking. So I describe it a story that as one of my students said to me, a student's on the basketball team, and he sat in my office and he said, you know, every day in the locker room, somebody says something offensive. And sometimes I say something and sometimes I don't. But what was interesting to me about that quote was that I wondered how many of his teammates are also saying, geez, that's really offensive. So you could have a bunch of guys in the locker room and, you know, 90% of them could say, that guy's a jerk and that guy like shouldn't say something. But each of them individually is like, oh, I guess all of my other teammates are cool with this. And so I think one of the things that's so important, and my own research and other people's research has actually shown this pretty clearly, that we often do misperceive the norms. You know, college students tend to think that other students are much more comfortable with drinking excessive amounts of alcohol use than they themselves are. Women think that other women are much more focused on being really thin than they themselves are. And I actually find that really hopeful because it means that if we can correct these misperceptions, we can hopefully inspire action.
I thought that the work that you talk about with regard to females in college and literally misseeing physical size, I mean, that was stunning.
Well, and I want to give full credit that research was directly the result of ideas that my thesis students had. These were not my ideas. Mm-hmm. So in the first case, a study I conducted at Princeton, it was conducted with a thesis student named Candy Messinger. I've done other research at Amherst College with a thesis student named Jenny Mutterpearl. And both of those studies specifically came out of women saying to me, I think this happens in the dining hall. And I was like, interesting. I wonder if it does. And it was absolute their own observations.
Wow. Okay, in a moment, we're going to ask you for a yes and story. And I know you did that for us before, but I'm going to count on you having another one. But I did want to talk just real quickly about this idea of moral courage and what it entails. Because you show through the evidence, through the science, that we have all these factors working against us in terms of how we're sort of wired and how we tend to react to things, but that there is a great need for moral courage in these moral rebels. And what does it take to get there?
So I think that is really the whole reason I wrote the book, is because I want to move people to get there. And I think what the research shows is two things. One, and I talk about this in chapter 9, we can look at people who do step up, the so-called moral rebels, and we can figure out, well, what kinds of traits do they have? How much do they care about fitting in? How much do they worry about standing out? How empathetic are they? Can they regularly and easily put themselves in somebody else's shoes? And these are all traits that we may be able to develop in ourselves, in our children, by modeling, by giving opportunities to practice particular skills. And so one, we can look to people who can do it and try to foster those traits. And then the other thing, which I talk about in chapter 10, are there lots of things that we can in fact do that are small steps. So things like, for example, finding a friend to do something courageous with us. It's much easier to act if somebody else is doing it. As you and I have just discussed, trying to change norms, trying to correct misperceptions that people have about norms is important. It's also really important to give people the tools that they need. So how can you stand up to sexist behavior or racist behavior or sexual misconduct? What are some specific skills and strategies that you can do that maybe aren't particularly heroic, but maybe are just little small steps that could feel more comfortable for people to do? And all of that can go a long way towards giving people the moral courage to step up.
You know, we talk, having worked at Second City for so long, my wife and I talk about the various ensembles, and they're mostly groups of six, and what makes some more successful than others. And almost always it comes down to who is the alpha in that group, and what is their attitude, and do they believe in the things that we want them to, the core beliefs of Second City, in terms of having each other's back, and that all of us are better than one of us. And if the loudest voice in the room isn't that, then the ensemble usually isn't doing very good work.
Right. That makes a ton of sense.
Yeah. All right. So I'm wondering if you have a yes and story for us to end the podcast.
So I do have a yes and story, but I feel compelled, Kelly, to just briefly say that in preparing for this podcast, of course, I thought about my last yes and when you and I spoke a year ago, and I talked about being the faculty advisor for the cancer support group, and you shared with me Nora's story. So I want to just acknowledge that.
Thank you.
Because I think about her and you and, you know, your family. But in terms of my current yes and, my current yes and is also about my college students. You can see how often I do things that I'm convinced to do by my students. Mm-hmm. So about 10 years ago, I had two students, excellent students, seniors, who were captains of their respective sports teams. And they came to me in December of their senior year, and they said, would you be willing to teach a class on sports psychology? Because we're seniors, we're psychology majors, you know, we're athletes, and we don't offer it now, and we and so many of our friends would love to take it. And I said, I really don't know anything about sports, and I'm really not athletic, which is, those are both totally accurate statements. And I said, but I'll go think about it. And my gut instinct, of course, given that I don't know anything about sports and I'm not very athletic and this is not my area of research, was to say no. Because, you know, designing a whole new course about something I really don't know anything about and don't have a personal passion for is a lot of work. Mm-hmm. So I went back home, I thought about it, and I basically said, you know what? These kids really want it. They really want it, which is why they had approached me. And although saying no would have been far easier and simpler, I said, yes, okay, I'll do it. And I actually designed a course, and I found that although I still don't know a lot about sports, I do know a lot about psychology. And I also found that it is far easier to teach a class that the students love that I don't particularly care about than the reverse. And in fact, they came every time, eager to share, eager to talk. I scheduled the class at 8:30 in the morning to try to, you know, decrease interest. That was a total failure. And ironically, about all this, I was then approached by a publisher and asked if I would do a sports psychology textbook, which I have now, in fact, done. And I will say that when I called my husband to tell him, you know, that offer, it would be hard for me to describe the length of time that he laughed about the idea of me actually writing a textbook on sports psychology. So I'm still in touch with one of those two students, and I will say it was something that I was not inclined to do. It was not a natural fit, but I'm so glad I said yes.
That is a fantastic yes and story. The book is called Why We Act, Turning Bystanders into Moral Rebels. Catherine Sanderson, thank you for coming on the show again.
Thank you so much for the invitation, Kelly.
Getting the SAN is produced by Second City Works and WGN Radio. Our editor and producer is L.F. Garris. We get support at the Second City from Jenny Crowley, Abby Bumbledare, Mike Farinaccio, and Colleen Fahey. The music you hear at the beginning and end of the show is by Jukebox the Ghost. If you have questions, guest ideas, or if you want more information on working with Second City Works, you can go to www.secondcityworks.com or you can email us directly at works@secondcity.com.
Survive.